Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, Policy Director Tori Gorman, and Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, Ben Ritz, will join the program to discuss how concerned we should be with federal budget deficits, a process known as reconciliation, and how Congress might use it in the coming years, as well as PAYGO standards and COVID relief. We're really covering a lot of territory. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Congressional Budget Office reported that the federal budget deficit was $572 billion in the first quarter of fiscal year 2021, $215 billion more than the deficit recorded during the same period last year. Roll Call is reporting that reconciliation, which lets lawmakers circumvent the Senate's 60-vote filibuster threshold, could be in play again. The incoming Biden administration and Democrats on both sides of the Capitol face the same challenge Republicans did in early 2001, how to use the budget process to enact their agenda with the slimmest of margins. Reconciliation has substantial limitations and can be time-consuming. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ben Ritz, Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, will join me to discuss how concerned the public and policymakers should be with federal budget deficits. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Ben Ritz. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director, a regular contributor on the show. Ben is director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. Prior to joining PPI, Ben staffed the Bipartisan Policy Center's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings, and he worked on other federal budget issues at BPC, including sequestration, budget process reform, and the federal debt limit. Before that, he was actually one of my colleagues, the legislative outreach director for the Concord Coalition. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Ben.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks for having me again.
Pleasure to have you on the program. And we're talking about a publication that you just wrote, Ben, about whether we should be concerned about growing federal budget deficits. And I'm just going to open it up with a really general question about the piece. When you're talking about concern one way or another on deficits, do you differentiate between short and long-term?
Yeah, I think there is a big important difference between short and long-term deficits. In the short term, we have an economy that has been deeply suppressed because of the coronavirus. People have lost their jobs, been unable to engage in typical commerce activities. And we need a government response to help the economy recover after the pandemic has ended, and also help people get through the pandemic. So we have programs like unemployment insurance and aid to businesses and aid to state and local governments that are all very important for sustaining the economy during this emergency and afterwards. Longer term, though, deficits could pose a much bigger threat, and we do need to be concerned about the long-term situation there.
All right. So Ben, based on what you just said there, it seems like you're implying that in your piece, you explain that maybe short-term deficits are less of a concern than, you know, how we should be approaching fiscal policy and growing deficits in the long term.
Yeah, I think that in the short term, there's actually a bigger risk of doing too little rather than too much. Maybe less so now that we have a fully democratic government. But if we were to spend too little in the short term, we could have longer unemployment than needed, higher poverty rates as we're trying to get out of the coronavirus pandemic. That would lead to slower growth in the future. And at a time when we have record low inflation and interest rates, there really is no reason why the federal government shouldn't be spending whatever money is necessary to get people through the crisis. But longer term, we don't know that those low inflation and interest rates are going to stay. Really, we have no reason to think that inflation and interest rates are going to be as low in a growing economy as they are in one of the worst economic crises of the last century. So it is a bigger, longer term concern. And then we also have these structural deficits that are a bigger problem that we need to get a handle on. And so short term, not something to worry about. Long term, we got to be concerned.
And before I get Bob involved in the conversation, I wanted to follow up on that real quick. You mentioned some of the potential negatives of basically being too tight-fisted when it comes to fiscal policy in the short term. Do we have any recent historical context for that? I mean, you made some pretty strong statements about some of the potential risks at a time where we have over a $3 trillion budget deficit and, you know, maybe around $2 to $3 trillion even in the coming fiscal year.
We do have recent context for that. Actually, after the financial crisis, a lot of folks, and I'm not suggesting, I don't think Concord was among them, is mostly on the right, that there were a lot of people who were suggesting that the immediate priority needed to be to get the deficit down. We had a $1 trillion deficit. We never had a $1 trillion deficit. And they said, you know, we have to cut it right away. And because otherwise we would have a fiscal crisis within the next couple of years. The bond vigilantes would come. We'd have skyrocketing borrowing costs and economic catastrophe. And we didn't actually really address the fiscal challenge. We made some cuts to discretionary spending that prematurely cut off stimulus, and that held back the recovery. But the underlying fiscal situation was not addressed. And yet none of the doomsday predictions came true. Inflation was ridiculously low for the last decade. There was only 1 year of the last 12 in which inflation hit the Federal Reserve's 2% target. Every other year it was below that. Net interest payments on the debt as a percentage of the federal budget are lower than they historically have been. And so in hindsight, if we look back at the Great Recession, we see that the recovery was prolonged because we were too tight-fisted. And the fears in the short term that people had been worried about didn't materialize. And so I think that means that we should have some humility this time around to say, let's be a little bit more aggressive in stimulating the economy before we are concerned about these long-term threats that may not materialize as soon as some people think.
Ben, one issue that's likely to come up is our old friend PAYGO, pay as you go. That's goes back to the 90s as a concept that says that if we're going to have new or expanded mandatory or entitlement spending programs, they should be offset somehow with cuts elsewhere or with tax increases. Or if you're going to cut taxes, you should cut spending commensurate with that or raise revenue someplace else. So one of the challenges, it seems to me, for the Biden administration which is coming in with an ambitious agenda and now a majority in both the Senate and the House, is going to be this, whether or not and to what extent to stick to PAYGO. So from what you've said before, a couple of questions come to mind. One is, A, do you worry about it at all? Or is it time to just junk PAYGO? B, what should it apply to if it applies? And let's just go with A and B right now, because then you can get into some permeations. But what are your general views about PAYGO and what it should apply to?
So I think what the House did recently was the right approach. They maintained the PAYGO principle, the PAYGO rules, but they added some two important exceptions. The first is spending to address the coronavirus pandemic. And so I think that is important for, you know, the reasons we said before about supporting the economy during this temporary crisis. It's not a long-term permanent spending program. It's dealing with a one-time emergency. It's exactly the appropriate type of thing where you do want to be able to borrow for. So I think that's a good exception. And I think the other exception they did, which is for long-term investments to combat climate change, is also worth making an exception for, because If you're spending money to mitigate trillions of dollars in damage from climate change in the future, that has benefits to the economy and the federal budget that might not be reflected in a traditional CBO score, but where offsetting it isn't as important as getting the policy right and being able to make the investments to reduce the long-term threat. So I think those are good exceptions. I think that with that not counting those areas of the budget, of the public investment and the short-term stimulus, I think we do need to be paying for things because we still have this structural long-term deficit that hasn't been addressed. And we just don't know if low inflation and interest rates are going to allow that to continue in perpetuity. And we need fiscal flexibility there.
Here's a comment. Maybe you can comment or just leave it there if you want to, but it does. I agree with you completely about the pandemic exception. I'm a little bit concerned about the climate change exception because it's so broadly written. In fact, I don't even know that it really is limited to investments, as you put it. There are a few words there about addressing current or future or prepare for or react to. There's a lot of things. And it does concern me, even though I think there's a case to be made for not being as aggressive with PAYGO on things that are truly investments. But as you know, if you have an exception to any rule, then Congress will find creative ways to put anything into that. The famous example being when spending for the 10-year census was once declared an emergency, as if nobody had any idea that it was coming.
You mean they're going to shove a bus through a pinhole, Bob? I don't know what you're talking about. That's never
happened. Yeah, so anyway, and maybe you don't need to address the climate change in particular, but I mean, shouldn't there be some criteria about what the exceptions are?
Yeah, I think that so two things I'll say on that. The first is, I think the criteria should be, is this an investment that we can credibly, plausibly say will benefit the economy in the long run more than it costs? Is this a policy that, at least in theory, could pay for itself? Very few policies actually do pay for themselves, and we saw that with the tax cuts. But is there at least a coherent way that this could generate economic growth or reduce the impact of climate change on the economy, such that we will be worse off or maybe even have a higher debt to GDP ratio if we didn't do it? I think that it is important to adhere to that spirit and, you know, make sure these exceptions are applied, you know, in the spirit in which they were designed, as opposed to justifying, a $90 trillion Green New Deal and say, well, it's green, it's climate change, therefore we can get away with it. I think the other point I would raise is that we saw that in the past, when Congress has wanted to override PAYGO, they have just done so. They are going to provide a waiver for whatever they think. If something is in violation of PAYGO and the majority really wants it, they're going to get it either way. And so I am hopeful, maybe not optimistic, but hopeful that having these exceptions, these clear, obvious exceptions where it is okay to not apply PAYGO written into the rule, might make them more reluctant to do that for the things that don't fall into those categories.
All right, so back to the publication. Okay. You talk a little bit about fiscal flexibility toward the end of the piece, using something called a fiscal switch. So I'm going to ask a question, but I do want you to explore that a little bit, what you mean by fiscal flexibility. But my question has more to do with the turning point, or if there is a turning point between basically not caring or caring a lot less about short-term deficits as we try to get the economy growing again, get through the pandemic, to focusing on long-term fiscal policy where we do have concern about growing deficits and a massive debt. So, and you've got things like MMT cropping up where basically they're saying there isn't a turning point, and if there is, it's way down the line. So the question is there a turning point? How do you measure it? And I'm wondering if that comes into play with your comments on fiscal flexibility in the piece.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I think that if you, a lot of the MMTers will say we can deficit spend in perpetuity until there's inflation, and then when there's inflation, we raise taxes or we deal with it then when inflation happens. In principle, all else being equal, that framework might make sense because if there's no, you know, if the government can borrow at a low interest rate and there's no inflation, maybe you can get away with that for some time. The problem is all else isn't equal. We have these giant structural deficits that are growing in the future because of the aging of our population. Our long-term tax and spending policies are not aligned, and it's going to grow even worse with the aging of the population because largest programs in the federal budget, like Social Security and Medicare, are growing significantly faster than the revenues needed to finance them. And so if we just take this MMT approach of we're not going to worry about this until inflation happens, and then we hit inflation, what then? If in 2030 we have significant inflation and rising interest costs, we've racked up more debt, we have made more promises on Social Security and Medicare to more people who are now retired, and that puts future policymakers in a no-win situation where they either have to suddenly cut benefits on people who've planned their lives around them, or they need to do it all on the tax side, which is going to fall exclusively on young workers while having asked nothing of the people of the generations who went up to that point without making their contributions to make those programs sustainable. Or they're going to do nothing and you're going to have inflation just continue. And so the problem with MMT is it ignores the structural impediments that would prevent Congress from swiftly moving once inflation takes place.
Yeah, that think it might be difficult for Congress to raise taxes quickly?
Is that a rhetorical question, Bob?
I know it was a rhetorical question, but I think that's an important element there, that number one, it would be incredibly politically difficult to do it on it, to enact major deficit reduction policy on a dime like that. But I think even if Congress could just snap their fingers and implement these policies, they would be bad. It would be bad policy outcomes to just suddenly do a massive tax increase just on young workers, or to suddenly cut Social Security benefits for people who have already retired and planned their lives around them. I think whether Congress acts quickly or not, that it's a no-win situation to be in. And so if we're going to try to push the envelope on seeing how much we can get away with stimulating the economy in the short term, and I think we should push the envelope on that, it would be much safer to do so if we didn't have to worry about the structural debt deficit in the background when inflation happens.
You talked about a fiscal switch in your fiscal flexibility section of the document. Is that something you'd recommend policymakers take into account here? Like, how would that even work? And is it easily done? You've been talking a lot about it. So explain to us what a fiscal switch is.
The fiscal switch would be a mechanism for triggering the shift from stimulus policies to deficit reduction. And that's maybe with more of the near-term focus. If you have in place a mechanism to go from deficits to deficit reduction when the time is right, then until you hit that threshold, you can really spend comfortably and not have to be too worried about the deficit. So I think that putting in place that kind of safeguard would enable and encourage policymakers to spend whatever they need to in the short run.
I just wanted to round out our exploration of technical terms here. We did PAYGO and switches. And so now I want to ask you about reconciliation.
Not just a small topic at the end of the segment.
So, but I mean, just to the Joe Biden's got a big agenda. And a lot of the stuff is going to be difficult to get through either house because of the narrow margins. In the Senate, you got a 50-50 split. So it's you know, you can look at that and you say, well, how the heck can you get anything past the Senate? Because everybody knows you got to get 60 votes to get anything passed. So there's this thing called reconciliation. Do you think that the Democrats will resort to this? And if so, are there political consequences? Maybe they get rid of the filibuster so they don't have to get into reconciliation. So just sort of the question is, how do they get a big agenda through the Senate?
I am pretty confident based on what Joe Manchin has said and other centrist Democratic senators, they're not going to get rid of the filibuster. So I think that was an overblown fear on the right. They're not going to get rid of the filibuster. But I think they are going to have to resort to reconciliation for some of their agenda items. And I think that would be appropriate because, you know, we saw under Trump and the Republican Congress, they used it to move their budget busting tax cut through on reconciliation on party lines. I think if Republicans really wanted to be constructive, work with President Biden on a bipartisan agenda that does adequate stimulus in the short term and deficit reduction in the long term and rolls back some of those tax cuts, I think that would be fantastic. I'm not holding my breath on that. And I don't think that most Democrats in Congress are either. And so I think it would be appropriate for them to use reconciliation as a tool to get some of those important agenda items done if they're not able to bring Republicans to the table in good faith.
Well, like you said, Bob, that was, I think, a good way to round out our conversation on technical terms. And we veered off course a bit from the topic of your paper, Ben, but I think we covered it pretty well in the beginning. And I appreciate you taking the time to go off course here. This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Ben Ritz discuss how concerned the public and policymakers should be with federal budget deficits short and long term, as well as a few other things like pay-as-you-go, fiscal switches, and reconciliation, which is actually a topic we're going to pick up on with our policy director, Tori Gorman, in our next segment. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Ben.
Thanks.
Thanks.
We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby, Tori Gorman, and once again, Ben Ritz. Bob and Tori both work for Concord, executive director, policy director, regular contributors. Ben just wouldn't go home. We had to have him back in the next segment. We realized there was a lot we didn't cover, and we want to have him as part of this upcoming conversation. Welcome back, all three of you.
Thank you.
I want to pick up this segment talking about something we mentioned in the previous segment, and that is the idea of fiscal flexibility and a fiscal switch. We just ran out of time to talk about this in a little more detail. One aspect of it was, and this is for you, Ben, how a fiscal switch would be enforced, and honestly, how gimmicks would be avoided relative to it.
Sure. So I think when it comes to the fiscal switch, the enforcement of it would be a combination of two things. I think the first is automatic stabilizers. So having policies that react directly to economic circumstances. So more robust unemployment insurance in recessions and you know, having that go down when the economy recovers, those sorts of policies and things like that that a lot of us pushed for earlier in the pandemic, I think would be helpful. I think there's also a lot of potential automatic tax and spending changes that you could tie to factors like interest rates and inflation. So another possible mechanism that we've been talking about is something we call a dynamic value added tax. And so this would be a tax you could put on the books to post pandemic help pay down the debt, and it would function sort of like a national sales tax. And you could set the rate based on however much deficit reduction you think we need. So if interest rates and unemployment are low, we have a lower VAT. If those start to rise and we really have to start tackling our debt, have the VAT in place, have all the mechanisms there, and you could just increase the rate. And the benefit of that would be it could, you know, sort of pull money out of the economy, slow down inflation, but it does it in a more generationally equitable way than doing benefit cuts to Social Security and Medicare that would take effect right away, or you know, increases in taxes that exclusively hit younger workers. And so trying to think about those broader mechanisms that could be responsive and more fair to everyone. And then the last element I'll say is very important, is public investment spending. I think that there are a lot of long-term investments we could make in infrastructure and scientific research. It makes sense to do more of them when we have the fiscal space to do it. when interest rates are low and inflation is low, let's do more infrastructure and public investment spending. And then when that changes, we can dial them back.
One quick follow-up before I hand it off to Bob. I know he wanted to pick your brain on a few things, including some recent and upcoming potential COVID relief legislation. On the automatic stabilizers within the switch and basically an automatic VAT based on certain requirements, I wonder, does that take Congress out of the driver's seat? Like, what part do they play in all of this? Is it good or bad that they have a smaller role?
So I think that, so first of all, Congress has to obviously put in place the mechanisms. I think that the part of the problem we have right now is that Congress has already taken itself out of the driver's seat to a large extent. You know, we have these mandatory spending programs that are growing, faster than the revenues we need to finance them. And Congress isn't doing anything about it. Now, part of the reason they're not doing anything about it is because they're focused on these short-term concerns. But even if, absent the pandemic, I'm not convinced they would have done anything on this. And so I think it's more a question of recognizing that Congress is going to take itself out of the driver's seat for a lot of these policies. Let's make sure the autopilot is going in a comfortable direction. And if Congress is always free to jump back in if they think the mechanisms aren't what's needed at that time, but let's have the default be something we're all comfortable with instead of something that we're not.
Chase, can I ask a quick question here? I guess the one question I have with these types of triggers and the VAT that you're talking about is, how do you make sure that new revenue source is dedicated towards paying down the debt and isn't used to finance new spending? I mean, we saw from the Greenspan Commission, they increased the payroll tax rate because they knew that they had baby boomers that were retiring. They set those funds away in a trust fund to hold bonds, but then the revenues from those bonds were then used to finance additional spending, such that all we have left are non-tradable paper bonds without value in order to pay future Social Security benefits. So I'm curious, given the difficulties that we have of one Congress constraining another Congress, any new revenues that we generate from this switch on, switch off VAT, how do we ensure that goes to deficit reduction and that Congress continues during this period to run a primary balance, if you will?
Two points I would make on that. The first is, I am a little less worried about the same thing happening again, given that we're now significantly of the way through the demographic shift to the baby boomers retiring. Once they have retired, I think that will level out a little more. So I think this one-time level jump is less likely to be repeated. I think more importantly, though, the benefit of the fiscal switch is that the deficit reduction is timed to take place when we need deficit reduction. And so I think that if you were to flood the government with new revenues at a time where, inflation and interest rates are low, there's going to be a lot of temptation to spend it. Or conversely, if you cut spending at a time when interest rates and inflation are low, there will be a temptation to waste that on tax cuts. That is literally what we saw happen during the Obama era. We cut all this spending. We had low inflation and interest rates. So we felt, okay, well, or not we, but congressional Republicans thought, well, okay, we can get away with this. We're going to do a $2 trillion tax cut. So I think the benefit of our fiscal switch approach and timing the deficit reduction to the economic cycle is that at the time when you get those revenues, there really won't be the temptation to spend it because we'll be at a point where everyone agrees that we can't afford to.
Well, let me pick it up from there and talk about targeting. And one thing that you had talked about before was kind of flooding the zone. That is to say that it's given the current situation, it would be better to overdo it in terms of fiscal policy than underdo it, which is something that the chairman of the Federal Reserve has also commented on. So you're in good company there. A couple of questions that come up from that is, what is the extent of overdoing it? I mean, where do you draw the line? Is there a line on overdoing it? And that gets into a question also about targeting. I thought that the last jobs report, the December jobs report, was really illustrated how how targeted this jobs loss is in certain industries, leisure, hospitality, that have been mostly affected by the pandemic. So you really have this split. Some call it a K-shaped recovery. There are different definitions of that, but one clearly shows that, you know, a lot of job sectors continue to increase steadily, but, you know, slowly but steadily, while others are plummeting. And if you look at what you might want to do on the fiscal side to address that, you know, does it make sense, say, to give $2,000 checks to everybody, blanketing the economy with it, where you clearly have just certain segments that are in the most dire need?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. Gonna sort of answer that a little bit backwards, starting with the point about the $2,000 checks. One stat that really jumped out to me was looking at the cost of the $2,000 checks versus something like unemployment insurance. So the issue I have with the $2,000 checks is if you have the same income you did before the pandemic, you have your job, you're going along just fine, you do not need $2,000 check. That is a lot of money to just kind of hand out for no reason. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, if you have lost your job and you're trying to pay rent and put food on your table, $2,000 is not enough. It's not even close to enough. And so I think we really do want to target that money. And the thing that jumped out to me is expanded unemployment insurance, which really does target, you know, people who have lost their jobs. For the same cost, or roughly the same cost as one $2,000 check, we could extend the expanded unemployment insurance that right now expires in March. We could extend that for the rest of the year. We could expand, you know, for the cost of the checks, we could expand the child tax credit for 10 years. The earned income tax credit, we could expand that one. Like, there are so many better uses of that money that are more targeted. And we're not saying don't spend that money. We're saying try to spend it on the right things. The corollary to that is, as you said, you know, we rather overdo it than underdo it. At the same time, I think it's also a question of how much. So all else being equal, it would be better to overdo it by 10% than underdo it by 10%. There's not really a question in my mind about that. But if you're asking, you know, is it better to overdo it by 200% or underdo it by 2%? I think that becomes a little more difficult to justify. And I do have some concern that we might be going more towards that latter circumstance if some people in my party get their way.
Well, I do think I agree. And I think that overdoing it on the... If you're going to overdo it, overdo it on the side of people and industries that really are affected by the pandemic. This is, you know, not the usual recession, as we've been saying since the beginning. It's highly specialized recession in some ways, which makes it, and you know, easier to respond to if you keep it more targeted. And if we're going to overdo it. Overdo it on areas that we clearly know need. And I take your point completely about unemployment benefits. You know, we've seen in the past unemployment benefits, state aid to keep people from being laid off those are important factors in keeping the economy going.
Okay, so something else we touched on in the last segment with you, Ben, and was intended to be the focus of this segment, but we've had some great conversation so far, is the topic of reconciliation or the reconciliation process. And Ben was asked about the potentially large agenda going through the Senate on the coattails of this process, which could basically help sidestep filibuster and the 60-vote majority needed to pass certain legislation. Ben actually said he didn't think the filibuster was going to go anywhere and that reconciliation was at times appropriate to use. So actually my question is for you, Tori, do you agree with Ben or do you have a different take?
I mean, I guess it depends on how much Republicans in the Senate are willing to cooperate. And that remains to be seen. I think you'll see some fingerprints when it comes to negotiating committee ratios, committee budgets, and other rules that will govern the Senate. If there are signals of cooperation, it would be, I think, my preference, but also members of Congress' preference to pass legislation via regular process. And the reason why is because bipartisan legislation is always the most durable legislation. When you try and pass legislation via reconciliation, the dirty little secret is that reconciliation in general produces crappy law. The rules and the restrictions that govern the contents of reconciliation really make it hard to create new law. It's really good at changing and making adjustments to existing law, but it's really hard to stand up new legislation just because of all of the restrictions. And plus you've got the Byrd rule that I think Ben mentioned in the last segment. The Byrd rule basically says that once you hit the end of that 10-year window, everything going forward cannot add to the deficit on a net basis. And what that ends up happening is that any kind of policies inside the window, the budget window, that raise spending and create deficits or reduce revenues and create more deficits in the out years, you have to turn them off. Okay, we saw that in the 2017 tax bill. All the corporate and international tax provisions, those were made permanent, but all the provisions affecting small business and individuals, those expire in 2025. And that just makes it impossible to plan, and it also makes really crappy tax policy. So I think, you know, there's sort of it's a double-edged sword when it comes to reconciliation. It definitely helps you pass legislation more quickly because it allows the Senate to act a little bit more like the House in terms of majority rules. But because of that, there are certain restrictions about what you can put into a reconciliation bill, and those restrictions can be really problematic in standing up good legislation. And I think you even saw that with Obamacare.
I think the Obamacare example is actually incredibly instructive, because what happened was a lot of people think that Obamacare passed via reconciliation, and that's only part of the story.
Right.
The Affordable Care Act first passed the Senate and the House as traditional legislation. It was traditional legislation. It passed the 60 vote majority. And then when Democrats lost the Senate and they wanted to make changes to that bill, they made those changes through reconciliation, but the underlying
sidecar,
had to be passed through the normal process. And so, realizing that even the Affordable Care Act couldn't have passed just through reconciliation.
And you mentioned some of the change, and this took place in Obamacare. This was an important factor. Some of the limitations of reconciliation, it must be directly related to spending and revenues. And try passing a major healthcare bill, for example, that doesn't have provisions that relate to healthcare, the provision of healthcare, rather than strict dollars and cents. You know, correct me if I'm wrong here, Tory, who used to follow this thing professionally in the Senate, wearing your parliamentarian hat. But I think that that's one of the crucial things, is what directly affects spending, and what is something that might be a quote unquote policy measure.
Sure, and even that is somewhat fungible. I mean, the first rule, the Byrd rule, is something that a provision, a matter, if you will, has to have budgetary effect. Okay, so it needs to change outlays or it needs to change revenues. And a matter can be something as small as a couple of words, or it can be an entire section of a piece of legislation. So it literally, adjudicating the Byrd rule is really a text-dependent exercise. But there are also some exceptions. You know, another element of the Byrd rule says, all right, something may not have budgetary effect, but if it is crucial as part of the terms and conditions of standing up this provision that does have budgetary effect, if you can demonstrate that something is a term and condition, you know, for example, saying we're going to raise the income tax 10%. Well, on whom? Okay. All those provisions that say on whom are considered terms and conditions. They themselves do not score. It's the change in the tax rate that scores, but they're essential terms and conditions, and so they're allowable. But there are also things that score that have budgetary effects, but they don't qualify for reconciliation. There's a provision in there that says essentially that if something is budgetary, it has to be central, right? It can't be a second order effect, if you will. For example, one of the examples that they like to use in reconciliation is overturning Roe versus Wade, Okay. It's very clear that overturning Roe versus Wade would have budgetary effects. It affects Medicare and other programs that we use for to support family planning in the United States. But the crux of that provision is to eliminate abortion. In other words, the primary gist of that legislation is policy in nature. It's not budgetary in nature. And so that would not comply under the Byrd rule and would not be allowed in a reconciliation bill. So you can see where things get a little dicey, and it's really, it's absolutely text driven. And so if anybody comes to you and says, oh, we can absolutely do this in reconciliation, you know, without looking at the text of that language, it's, you really can't tell. You really need to see what the text looks like, what the CBO score looks like, and then you're off and running and making your legal arguments from there.
It seems to me that there's going to be quite a parliamentarian's field day on this. And it goes back to the point where it would be better to have bills that have sufficient bipartisan support that you could get them through without having to use reconciliation. Because the other thing is, as you mentioned, you create these fiscal cliffs at the end of 10 years. If you can't stuff everything in and pay for it, then you just assume that it all expires.
Well, and to use Ben's language, I think all of this is incredibly instructive on the process. It being used on the 2017 tax cuts, changes to the Affordable Care Act, which are all still basically partisan fighting lines. It, you know, it's also kind of like a smokescreen that hides the real costs of any legislation. You know, policymakers are going to extend the individual tax cuts in 2025. So was this the intention of reconciliation when it was first started to be basically a partisan sidestep to normal order?
So the originally reconciliation was developed as a way to make changes to direct spending and revenue programs quickly. I mean, those are things that are hard to change. So Congress every year is supposed to pass a budget resolution. Sometimes the direct spending and revenue contours do not comport with the budget resolution, and it's necessary to make changes within the span of a session of Congress. That doesn't happen exactly very quickly, especially in the Senate when you've got the legislative filibuster. So both parties joined hands in the Congressional Budget Act, and they created this process called reconciliation, and it's a very special feature. It's only used when the chambers can come together and produce a blueprint on which they agree on, and then they move forward to make changes typically to existing programs in order to reduce the deficit. So they're talking about raising taxes and cutting spending. In recent years, starting in around the 2000, and I will say it was used on a bipartisan basis. You know, the 1996 welfare reform, that was done on a bipartisan basis. The OBRA 1998, which balanced the budget for a couple of years, that was a reconciliation bill, and that was done on a bipartisan basis. But then you start in 2001, and we start using reconciliation to cut taxes. And that's when sort of the wheels came off the bus for reconciliation being used as a means to reduce the deficit and more as a means to jam through partisan policies when both parties control both chambers of Congress and the White House.
All right. So Ben, I'm going to end it on a question to you, and we're getting back to politics and the new Congress and the Biden administration on this one. Do you see the Biden administration trying to move its agenda through regular order first, or is reconciliation going to be the default out the gate?
I think the Biden administration is going to try to do whatever they can through regular order, but I don't know how patient they will be about it. And it sounds worse than it is, but I think that President-elect Biden has been a deal maker throughout his life. He campaigned on bringing the country together. I believe he sincerely wants to do that and will, whenever Congress is willing to work with him on that, will always prefer to take the bipartisan approach as opposed to the partisan one. But that said, we're in the middle of a pandemic and an economic crisis. Unemployment benefits were only extended until mid-March. You know, the vaccine distribution has not gotten off to a great start. We will need additional measures here. And I don't think he can afford to spend, you know, 6 months going back and forth with Republicans only for them to, you know, leave him high and dry like they did with President Obama and the ECA. So I think he will work as much as possible. I would like to think he will work as much as possible to get across the aisle, but I think he'll also, I think and hope he'll also know when it's time to walk away and just, you know, get it done, because it needs to happen. It needs to happen quickly. Mm-hmm.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and listening to me, Tory Gorman, Bob Bixby, and Ben Ritz from the Progressive Policy Institute. We discussed reconciliation, how it might be used by elected leaders, picked up on topics from our earlier segment with Ben on a fiscal switch, targeted COVID relief, and more. Thanks for joining the show and covering a wide range of topics this week, Ben, Bob, and Tory.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.